Hey everyone, welcome back to Wrong Think. We're making some changes as we try to figure out the best format of bringing you urgent and interesting conversations every week. In the meantime, you can find Jeff Marr at his Substack, I Might Be Wrong, and I'll be in this space bringing you a series of conversations with people you may know or that I think you'd like to get to know. This week, I'm talking to my friend and just all-around incredibly dope person, Chloe Valdari, about social media cleanses, microdosing mushrooms, disorder in the subways, anti-racism versus genuine integration, and a lot more. I hope you enjoy it and let us know what you're thinking. And now here's Chloe.
The way our left hemisphere perceives the world is as objects to be controlled and exploited and dominated, whereas the right hemisphere sees the gestalt, essentially, the wholeness of everything. And he argues that in a lot of Western civilization, the left hemisphere took over, our way of seeing and our way of being. And then this book by James Bridle, he argues about how we need to basically go back to that more, or root the left hemisphere perception in a more holistic right hemisphere perception.
Okay, so you're
I like mic drop.
Yeah, tell me about that. You have this amazing routine where you do social media dieting every other day.
Yeah.
You do microdosing every other day.
Not every other day. One day on, 2 days off. Also for social media, one day on, 2 days off.
Oh, I see. It's 2 days off. I misunderstood that.
Yeah. The 2 days is really important. So you can reset in the non-social media world, like fully immersed.
That first day, you're just kind of easing into it.
Yeah. The buzz is still there from the dopamine. Although I have found over time,
the social media buzz is still there from the dopamine.
Yeah, even though I'm not on. Mm-hmm. But over time, that buzz actually decreases the longer that I do this diet.
That's interesting because you and I have been in these dirty Twitter trenches for a while now. I met you on Twitter some years ago. And, you know, you write, you answer on Twitter, you become a kind of reliable presence. And over years, you gain followers. And then at some point you feel like it's a part of you to be somebody that, you know, regularly engages there. So you used to tweet a lot.
Yeah.
But then I did notice, I don't know, like sometime during the pandemic or something, you made conscious decisions to take Twitter breaks and you would say, I'm out for a while. And then you would disappear. And you didn't make that effort to constantly chase more and more followers at some point, you know, because you were gaining during the pandemic, people were putting on 1,000 followers a week and stuff. And you and Aisha Akanvi made a choice at some point to not just keep chasing that indefinitely, but to take breaks.
For sure. So in 2020, that was the year that my Twitter following actually started exponentially increasing. Mm-hmm. And I remember it was the summer of 2020, George Floyd, Black Lives Matter, and I started publishing pieces about Dr. King in response to everything that was happening. And that was when the uptick started. But also in 2020, that was the year I started meditating. And so these two things influenced each other. And the meditation practice that I have, as well as some of the other things we spoke about, influenced me to get really conscious about how I'm showing up online, and also about being very careful when my sense of identity or sense of self-worth becomes attached to whether it's a following on Twitter or whether it's something more simpler is like my ability to immediately respond in a very aggressive, adversarial way. Mm-hmm. Like I'm very conscious and cautious of having my identity be wrapped up in that, which is why I take breaks.
What was the turning point? Because I feel like I've gone through similar experiences, but I've never actually brought myself to a true Twitter detox.
Yeah.
What was the thing that happened or you said or someone said to you that you were like, you know what? I don't need this. For me, it should have been when I was somehow being screamed at by Emily Ratajkowski and
a
few million people.
That
should have been a time for me to just say, you know what? I don't need this, but I didn't do that. What was it for you?
Well, I feel like this is also heavily influenced by my startup, which is Theory of Enchantment. And like my startup is a practice that I'm basically selling to people and corporations and schools and stuff. And the whole idea is to become more integrated as a human being so you can show up in the world and in your relationships and in your community in a way that's like more loving, basically. Mm-hmm. And like that will actually end up creating, you know, whether it's a more compassionate society, actually anti-racist society, etc. So like the fact that my work entails building and selling a lot of that, I have to embody the practices and the principles that I'm promoting. And so I don't know if there was like a specific inflection point that caused me to say, you know what, I'm not going to do this, or like specifically an inflection point on Twitter itself. Mm-hmm. But the first time I took a break from Twitter was last year. I went to Mexico for 2 weeks and I was just like off Twitter the entire time and Instagram. I was off all social media.
And you're like, damn, this feels good.
Yeah. It was hard at first. Don't get me wrong. Uh-huh. But like I wanted to challenge myself to successfully complete it. And I'm also just an avid reader. And I don't say that to be obnoxious. I mean, the rate at which I read and the amount of books that I read is somewhat frightening. And a lot of the books that I was reading at the time were also about this, like, let's be conscious, let's be integrated, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And so all these things were sort of talking to each other. And I think that's what ultimately led me to make this decision. And I know that you are on the Red Scare pod. I'm a huge fan of the Red Scare pod. It's like the only pod I listen to religiously. And they were talking.
Shout out to Anna and Dasha.
Shout out to Anna and Dasha for being the best.
They're really good at what they do.
Good at what they do. But I was listening or reading their tweets about Lent. Like how they wanted
Dasha's
to like
Catholicism.
Yeah, exactly. And so I'm not Catholic, but I was like, you know, that's interesting. That's an interesting idea. And so this year I took off Twitter for all of Lent. I was off Twitter.
Okay.
And so that was like an anchor for my now diet, which is one day on, 2 days off.
So how long? It's only been for a few weeks that you've been like that then.
For that diet, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
But it makes sense. It's kind of, yeah, it's nice. You don't have to do like a complete leaving everything that you built up, but you don't have to be a slave to it either.
Exactly.
Yeah. Because sometimes I feel like sometimes I wake up in the morning and I've got the phone in my face.
No,
and like,
Thomas.
And then I'm reading notifications. I'm like, this is in control of
that,
me.
That
you know, like
dopamine.
Why? Yeah. It's like, why am I waking up that way? Usually I just try to wake up, put Michael Barbaro on the daily, get my coffee, crawl back into bed. It controls too much of my, there's an aspect of my thinking that's always like, you know, they talked about this when Instagram first started blowing up, that you're like on vacation or you're with your family and you're not seeing the moment, you're seeing the potential post.
Yeah.
And like there are all of these times when I'm reading a book and it's Albert Camus or something, you know, something timeless. Yeah. And I'm scanning the page and I'm realizing there's like something to pull for a tweet. And it's like, it's degrading my experience in the moment.
Yeah.
But I remember speaking of how much you read, I remember the last time we were in conversation was last year in Aspen and you were posted up women who run with wolves, right? That was, you were just posted up around the campus at different times of day.
Classic.
Reading that. I've started to see that book all around. Like
really?
I hadn't heard of it before I saw you with it, but now I'm noticing different friends have it on their coffee tables.
Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah, that's a great text for specifically like individuation, which is broadly speaking a process by which a human being comes to be fully rooted, fully integrated, able to hold their shadows and their lights within them with a kind of ease and not with a kind of like either seeing themselves as a victim of it or the opposite. That book is specifically in service of that, but for women. So it's a series of fairy tales, really, and stories collected from all around the world. But the author is actually showing how these fairy tales are explaining a growing process for women that women can take from it and apply it to their own lives. And so it's really,
it's a really
deep and powerful book. I hope I get this right. Clarissa Pinkola Estes, I believe, is her full name. But yeah, she's great. It's a beautiful text.
Okay, cool. I'm going to eavesdrop on the conversation that she's having with women. I'm going to try to see what the knowledge is.
Please do.
Separating the light and dark. So what are you reading right now?
What am I reading right now? So I'm a huge fan of Carl Jung, and I'm a huge fan of a lot of the women who were his colleagues. Marianne Woodman was incredible colleague of his. And she wrote a book called Addiction to Perfection, which I read last year and I often revisit. I'm reading another book by her called The Pregnant Virgin, which is fascinating. Similar theme. I'm reading another book by James Bridle, and I don't remember the title because it's so long, but it's basically about how we as human beings, how we evolved as a species, like the way we got here was to be present with it's paradoxical to say present with nature because technically speaking, everything is nature, but I'm just going to say that. We evolved by being present with nature. And I don't know if you're familiar with Ian McGilchrist's work.
I don't think so. Yeah.
So he wrote a book called The Master and His Emissary, which is about the two brain hemispheres, the right and the left. And he argues that the left brain, the way our left hemisphere perceives the world is as objects to be controlled and exploited and dominated, whereas the right hemisphere sees the gestalt, essentially, the wholeness of everything. And he argues that in a lot of Western civilization, the left hemisphere took over our way of seeing and our way of being. And then this book by James Bridal, he argues about how we need to basically go back to that more, or root the left hemisphere perception in a more holistic right hemisphere perception.
Okay. So you're
I like it. Drop.
So this is fascinating to me. So you're reading Jungian psychology.
Yeah.
You're taking 2 days off for every day on social media. And you're also rotating in and out of mushrooms.
Yeah. Microdose.
One day on, two days off. Yeah. What's that like?
It's cool. I think that shrooms are definitely my medicine of choice, if we want to call it a medicine. And how would I describe the shroom experience? For me personally, enhances that sort of like right hemisphere way of seeing, of seeing the interconnectedness of all things. You know, anytime I say the word interconnectedness, I immediately think of The Lion King when Mufasa told his son, he was like, everything is the great circle of life. And Simba was like, Mufasa goes, oh, we there's the antelope and here we are. And then Simba goes, but don't we eat the antelope? And then he has to, you know, show his son the way. And he goes, yes, but when we die, our bodies become the grass and the antelope eat the grass. And so everything is connected. So yeah, I would say shrooms like enhances my perception of that.
Okay. And it helps your work too? Writing? And, yeah, you think
for
so?
For sure. Yeah, because
I'm curious. I've never tried it ever. I've never tried anything other than the coffee that I rely on to change my state for work. Yeah.
What? I am shocked to hear that. You struck me as someone who, at least in an early life, dabbled.
No. I mean, I'm not a teetotaler. I will drink in the evenings and stuff. But like for working or for focus, the only thing I've ever relied on is caffeine.
I see. Yeah. I don't necessarily take it for work specifically, but it's becoming increasingly hard to separate.
Interesting.
The work life in my own world. It's like everything is permeating everything else.
But then if you're taking shrooms every few days, how does that affect your like working out and your physical fitness and things like this? Because you're also paying attention to that.
Yeah.
How does that integrate?
So does it, because it's a microdose,
it doesn't actually prevent you from going to the gym?
No, it's very subtle. Huh. It's a very low, not even a humming. It's like less than a humming.
But what does it do then? I really am asking from complete ignorance.
Yeah.
If it's so low and just a hum, what does it actually augment or change?
Are you familiar with Terrence Malick's work, the film director?
A bit, yeah.
Okay, so have you seen any of his films?
Yep.
So which films have you seen?
Oh, God. What is what's like this slow ass film?
All of his films
from 10 years ago.
Tree of Life?
Yes. Yeah. I saw that.
That's the one. That's the one.
Visually beautiful.
Yeah.
Is what I can tell you.
So Terrence Malick is my favorite film director. And I don't know if you remember the wife's sort of, basically his way of filming and the way he captures nature and the character's relationship to nature. That's what I'm experiencing when I'm microdosing on shrooms.
Wow, you're like living in you're living in your favorite director's.
Yeah, exactly.
Cinematic world.
Exactly. Okay.
That's a good sell. I mean, for me, like I would like to be in like a Michael Clayton film or something like that.
I don't know if I've seen any of
Born films. Identity. Oh. I'd like to, you know,
keep drinking coffee. Just continue with what you're doing. You're doing it right. But that's like very like high energy. Isn't it?
It's that's like, not going to be shrooms for me. That's going to be something. It's for me to be like, that's going to be steroids or something if I'm going to be in the Born Identity.
Yeah. Also, like I would worry if, how would I be able to stay? There's a kind of paranoia in that.
That's true. That is true.
There's a kind of paranoia that can take over your life if you're constantly in that stage.
That's very true.
It's a bit tricky to define philosophy.
Mark and Mark.
Philosophy is our attempt to get our bearings in the broadest sense possible. What is the nature of reality? What are we supposed to achieve with our lives in order to live a worthy life? Philosophy is not defined by its answers, but by the way that it pursues its questions. There's metaphysics, ethics, and there's epistemology. No appeals to revelations, to Holy Scripture are permissible. Science didn't itself discover its own methodology. That would be putting the horse before Descartes. That was a pun, and I promise I won't do that again. What is the self? Do we even know that it exists, much less what it is? Such questions as the hard problem of consciousness, the problem of personal identity, the problem of free will. And for all of these problems, different philosophers will reach very different conclusions on the basis of their philosophical reasoning. This series is not, after all, an introduction to the history of philosophy, but to philosophy itself. That we can really make some progress together in orienting ourselves in the world, scrupulously examining our intuitions and presuppositions. What manner of person do you want to be? What manner of person ought you to be? And cut.
So if we get in this AI future where, you know, work is solved and, you know, every...
Well, that's a big statement.
That's a big statement. But we get to this future that people sometimes speculate has to happen if we're going to avoid a complete social breakdown, and you have some type of universal basic income.
Yeah.
Then would more people be able... Would the goal be that then we would lose some aspect of ourselves and our meaning, and we would have to find other ways of relating to this world that...
For sure.
...is our context. Would that be... Would everybody needs to be microdosing or using other ways of accessing states of mind to kind of compensate for the loss?
Not necessarily microdosing, but yes, to the second thing. I think that we're already in a meaning crisis. So when people present it as if like, oh, our relationship to meaning will change. Our relationship to meaning is already crumbled and it is crumbling and is actively crumbling. Also, I think that like a lot of our relationship to work has been heavily mediated by Protestantism.
Oh, just very
like
much so, yeah.
Deeply, right? And the Protestant work ethic and Calvinism. And that is a whole worldview. And that is a whole set of perceptual, I don't want to say biases, but I'm using that neutrally. I'm using that term neutrally when I say biases. And so, yeah, that's ossifying, that's crumbling. And we are going to have to create new ways of being. And I don't think everyone will have to microdose. I don't think I'll be microdosing forever, right? For the rest of my life to be in this state. There's also a lot of other, I say a lot. There's just like, you know, I meditate daily. Mm-hmm. I'm reading the books that I'm reading. So it's not just a microdosing. Mm-hmm. It's like a whole thing.
Entire practice.
And in that sense, I do think more people are going to have to become sincere about developing a practice.
But that seems to me like it's an enormous crisis looming, not just with, you know, if we solve work or work becomes obsolete, but also just if we no longer... AI is such a, you know, it's a ubiquitous topic right now, but if it's even like partially what people expect it could be, it's got so many implications. You know, it's not just the UBI and the work, but it's also if all of the answers and the real capacity to create knowledge and to, you know, do science and, you know, to do law and to do so, to write, you know, to write compelling stories or analyses of today's news events. If all of that is really being done as well as humans can do it or better by AI, I mean, we're going to have to think hard about what grounds us, what we get meaning from. I mean, much of your work is about the crisis of meaning. I think that's, you've connected this to the polarization in our politics,
to the
inability of us to transcend racial categorization and differences. And I think that that's going to be really emphasized more and more going forward.
Do you think that, what do you think is going to be emphasized specifically?
The need for us to take seriously the lack of meaning. I think we get to kind of put that on the back burner because there's so many pressing kitchen table issues always to take care of. But were those things to be taken off the table, we'd have to confront, you know, the abyss, the emptiness of so much life. And you know, I live most of the time, I live in Paris. And there's such, you know, social upheaval right now about the right not to be forced to work longer. Mm-hmm. You know, the raising of the retirement age from 62 to 64 was a massive.
Yeah. I feel like we would never protest that.
We would never protest that here because that is not a Calvinist Protestant right. society. Right. There are real differences. We live in a society that has a very different relationship to work. Mm-hmm. And I think that were work to be solved, the French, you know, not a perfect society, but they wouldn't have some of the same crises of sure. meaning that you would notice here in America.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, productivity as the highest value on the hierarchy of values is such a huge thing in America. And it's affected not just, you know, our relationship to work, but pop culture. I think about, and also gender, which we can get into. So like I wrote a recent piece in my Substack about the intersection of what it means to have your sense of self dependent upon how productive you are, especially if you're a man, and the higher rates at which men are dying. Mm-hmm. Compared to women, whether it's from COVID or
deaths of despair,
you know, stuff like that. And so I think, you know, we're already full of crises mm-hmm. right now, but we can't see them. They're mm-hmm. not so apparent to us. We're sort of just like going about our day in a very ho-hum fashion. But there's already arguably COVID-19 level crises that, mm-hmm. that we face at present. I think about this also in hip hop, right? Like hip hop is about the accumulation of wealth, mm-hmm. right?
It's very American.
It's so Protestant also, mm-hmm. right? And there was this whole...
You show your blessed status literally on your body by how many chains you can
wearing.
Display.
Right, exactly. Dave Chappelle, you know, had this joke about Kanye, the billionaire. He's like, I don't... A billionaire doesn't wear his chains. And mm-hmm. then when he became a millionaire, he's like, get your chains out. but yeah, it's like prominent in the culture. And I don't know if you saw recently, there was this whole thing on The Breakfast Club with, you know, Ebony K. Williams.
Why do I know the name? The name sounds familiar to me, but I can't place it.
So she was on Real Housewives of New York. She's like been a regular guest
on The Breakfast Club.
I know her through a friend, actually. Uh-huh. I haven't really sat down with her to talk to her one-on-one, but I really want to. And I reached out and she said she would. So that should happen soon. But there was this whole controversy because, you know, she's very successful. She's very wealthy. She was asked by Jan Levon Zant if she would ever date a bus driver. And she said...
And she just said something terrible.
No, she didn't say anything terrible. It's not... She didn't actually say anything terrible. She said, I would date him if he owned the bus. Which I don't actually think is terrible. I think I could disagree with it. I could mm-hmm. agree with it. But it's whatever. It's her personal preference, right? But then, of course, inevitably, people piled on her. Mm-hmm. And then she doubled down. And when she doubled down, what she said when she doubled down, in my opinion, was terrible. So then she became terrible in her statements. And she basically made it about like a lesser value sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And she was invited onto the Breakfast Club to discuss it. She disagreed with that description. But I think it's very clear if you listen to her follow-up comments. She's making this argument about how, like, if you get C's and D's, I'm not going to tell you that your C's and D's are okay. I'm going to expect you to do better. And it's wrapped up in all these conversations about Black excellence, right? And the entrepreneurial sort of striving. Mm-hmm. I grew up with Black Enterprise magazine mm-hmm. in my house, right? So I'm like hearing this and I'm like drawn back to that time and seeing those things. And so, yeah, I say all this to say that I don't have answers, but the conversation is happening in many different, you know, parts of the culture, whether it's hip hop and Black culture or whether it's in psychological circles. And I think that there could be an interesting way for all these people to start talking to each other. Mm-hmm. I think that would be so cool.
But that's the thing. Like you mentioned The Breakfast Club or something, like we don't actually often talk to each other, even with the kind of the ubiquity of the internet and everything. Everyone's still having separate discussions. And I've always been convinced that we're not going to get past a lot of what is polarizing mm-hmm. and balkanizing our society, mm-hmm. So long as we continue to be so segregated. We have to have some type of sense of national, I don't know if fraternity is the word, but national identity that transcends the ethnic and skin color differences. And it keeps being evident to me that we're getting farther and farther away mm-hmm. from that idea. I mean, I've just been surprised by what I've been able to see, certainly since, you know, the summer of 2020, but even in the past year since like Elon took over Twitter mm-hmm. and I just see more of the nastiness, I've been surprised how much so many people don't actually even hold that as a goal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And like, if you talk about like, you know, the kind of like the urban crime, which I'm very interested in, or like the kind of the horrible kind of story that came up this week mm-hmm. with Jordan Neely on the subway, you see how divided people's perceptions of the same events are immediately filtered through these kind of ideological lenses. And this idea that we are not all in this together, trying to get to a common sense of meaning and an American identity. I don't know what the answers are. I mean, I certainly can see, you know, there are enormous problems, you know, mm-hmm. in American cities, mm-hmm. specifically since COVID. There mm-hmm. always is some element of chaos in American urban life. But, you know, since COVID, things have been kind of noticeably worse. Mm. I mean, the West Coast is truly insane to me. You know, this time last year, I spent some time in Portland and Seattle, and I was just blown away by the amount of, you know, disorder that's permitted. Mm. But you know, I was living in New York for a decade before moving to Paris in 2011. I come back a lot, but I've been back more and more, and now I've been back teaching in New York State and in the city a lot for the past few months, and just it's really been impressed on me the degree to which an amount of disorder has been creeping back into New York City life in a way that I don't remember from when I was here in the early aughts. Through, you know, in the Obama era.
Yeah.
And I wonder, you've been in New York for a while now. I mean, I wonder, what is your feeling when you're getting on the subway? I mean, are people blowing this type of thing out of proportion to score points on Twitter? Or
I mean, they definitely are. And and there is a problem on the subways. I mean, it's not so common or regular, though.
But there's like, the actual violence is not so common or regular. But yeah. I noticed there's a mood that seems angrier, more potentially uncontrollable or something. There's a different energy in the subway. It was much worse a year or two ago after the subways emptied out. Right. And the subways are filling back up. But still, like, you know, I've noticed that, like, you can be on a packed subway on a morning and somebody will just light a joint, you know? And there's an edge to that because it's intensely antisocial that you don't know exactly what can happen. It's like the possibility of violence is in the room now if people are disregarding norm. And the video of Jordan Neely is extraordinarily disturbing.
Yeah, I'm not going to watch it.
But one of the things that you see if you watch it is that there's the white Marine who's got him in a hold, but then there's like a brown skinned guy who's holding his hands and there's a black guy standing right by, and it's actually not. And so the kind of the immediate way that everybody talks about it is they go straight to their racial argument list. Yeah. And so then you got like Nicole Hannah-Jones and people like that. This is a lynching.
Right.
I'm not sure that that's exactly.
I just want to say that is really irresponsible.
It is, right?
That is so profoundly irresponsible. And she should know better. So I think it's important to state that. And for those of you who are watching this, if this is your go-to default thing to do, especially if you have such a huge platform,
it's really irresponsible.
Be very careful with your reaction and respond. And those are not the same things.
Right.
Right. There's a subtle distinction between those two things. And this, that is so irresponsible.
Well, I was shocked. And she wasn't the only one. Mark Lamont Hill, this is a lynching.
Well, that doesn't
this
shock
is,
me.
This is a modern, this is contemporary lynching.
Mark's response doesn't shock me. But
first of all, words need to mean something. It was not a lynching. I think that it's extraordinarily sad and unfortunate and probably unnecessary that this 30-year-old man, Jordan Neely, died. And I've tried to put myself, this is something that I'd like to talk with you about too, because so many people talk about it through the lens of race, politics, even just poverty. But this is on the spiritual level too. Can you imagine the despair of walking into a train and saying, I'm exhausted from being hungry, from being thirsty, and no one cares? And I mean, that is actually, I'm not sure that is mental illness. I think that because I pass in any city you're in, and this is not just an American problem, this is a human problem in Paris, anywhere, you pass people who are on the street and every day they're on the street and they're struggling to get even enough to eat. And I mean, it's almost surprising that they're not screaming every day, I can't take this, I can't live like this anymore.
Sure. Yeah. There is a despair that has seeped into our society. And I actually think the despair is what to be full of grace, to be graceful. I think that despair is actually what animates the automatic reaction to say, oh, this is a lynching. Oh, this is class warfare, you know, whatever. I think that the despair piece drives the tendency to try and immediately look at it in a very black and white lens.
Because it's almost like we can't handle.
Right, because it's a way to control the situation.
Yeah,
right?
I know what you mean.
It's a coping mechanism.
What would it mean for us to actually try to peer into how dark modern life has become, that we have thousands of people in every city in this situation? And most of us, you know, have our headphones on, we're looking at our iPhones and we don't want to think about it. Even the good woke progressive responses are kind of profoundly disturbing. Her name is Bess Kalb.
I think I'm familiar with some of her.
A journalist.
Yeah.
She's kind of a name that pops up on Twitter. She tweeted something that on the surface seems nice, but actually is insane.
What did she tweet?
She said, you know, she was immediately reacting. Mm-hmm. She didn't say lynching, but you know, this was murder.
Right.
I just want to say, like, this was horrific. I think that it got out of hand, but I don't believe that anybody intended. Mm-hmm. I really don't, but without being there and just from the evidence I can see, it doesn't look like people set out to kill this man for being poor, as there's a kind of discussion framing it. But she said, you know, I've been in New York for years and this is a situation that happens all the time. And I carry granola bars for this reason. You just give them a dollar and a granola bar, like problem solved. And that kind of got quote tweeted a lot. People started to notice, like, what the hell?
Yeah.
Like, you good white progressive woman with your purse full of a few extra granola bars in case you run into like a representative of the underclass. You know what I mean? And then you feel good about yourself and you're like a better person than people who are actually saying that there is some aspect of the government's responsibility that is not being performed. You know, I think first and foremost, just to give a little bit of context, Jordan Neely is a person who was apparently horrifically traumatized in his life. His stepdad killed his mom when he was a teenager. Mm-hmm. He's been living in the streets. He had some talent as a dancer. He was performing as Michael Jackson. And he was trying to survive.
Yeah.
But he had also been arrested some 40 odd times and clearly had mental health disorders and needed some type of intervention from the state that didn't happen. He also had an active warrant. I mean, it seems to me that the state has abdicated its role over and over again in preserving a kind of order in the streets. And it's not just a racial thing. I mean, the other night I was walking to an after party, like 26th Street at the Ritz Hotel. And outside of the Ritz, you know, it's almost like a Latin American feeling where there are security guards guarding the door. So people who are going into the Ritz are safe. But there's a white guy screaming racial epithets against BLM and N-words and I'll harm people, just ranting and raving in the street. And, you know, there's an edge. And it's not, people always say when you mention, you know, disorder in an urban context, that's anti-Black language. But no, this is not it's not simply a racial matter. There's a matter of our government, our local government, not preserving a certain modicum of order in public space that makes it harder for everybody to flourish, and everybody's more vulnerable, less safe.
Yeah.
And then you have a situation like this where citizens on the subway think they're taking it into their own hands because
no one else is stepping up. Yeah. I mean, this this reminds me of so much Alienated America by Timothy P. Carney, where he talks about the breakdown of civil society and how it led to the election of Trump in the primary. When you said the government abdicating its role, I also thought, we as citizens, and I count myself in this, like forfeiting our participation with the government or in government.
Absolutely.
In local government, right? I mean, it is a abdication of responsibility on the part of all of us, ultimately. And then the question becomes, what do we do about it? I find myself, because of my, you know, my social media diet, I say things now, like on my Substack and, you know, even in vocal active conversation, where I am not qualifying my statements. Like, I'm not, because by being off social media, I'm attuned also to a different rhythm that's happening live, right? Mm-hmm. And it's different than the rhythm that's happening on Twitter. And it's far more full of dimension and dimensionality. And I can play with that. I can play in that space without feeling the need to qualify my statements about, like, oh, you might see, you might perceive this somehow as anti-black or
you, right. I mean, I even had to do this
as anti-trans. Yeah. Like, no, we're going to be humans in the present moment. And we're going to have a jam session, right? Mm-hmm. We're going to try to do jazz actually mm-hmm. in this conversation. And it's a musical orientation. It's a call and response orientation. It's live, it's vital. And that's the space that I choose. I make a conscious choice to be in. And it's so that's also partially why I take breaks, because it messes up my filter if I'm like, on it too long.
Mm-hmm. This is a question that occurred to me. You're the perfect person to talk to about this. What would the appropriate response be in a situation like that? If in fact somebody mm-hmm. steps into your subway car, mm-hmm. you're not alone. So it's not just your problem. There are many people there. Mm-hmm. They say, I'm so tired of being hungry. I'm so tired of being thirsty. No one cares.
Yeah.
I'll hurt anyone. I'm ready to go to jail. I'm ready to die.
Yeah.
But they also are, he was not physically imposing.
Sure.
He didn't identify anybody and come towards them.
Sure.
What's the better way to handle that? Or what is the way we should think about handling that? And maybe you don't know, but yeah. You seem like somebody that would be good to talk to about that, because I've tried to think, what would the right response be? I mean, I certainly wouldn't, my first reaction wouldn't be to yoke him up into a chokehold.
Right.
It wouldn't
be. Yeah. No, I think that's right. So I don't know what I would do in that situation, but I would hope that if I encountered, or if I was with people who encountered this, that other people did have like access to a water bottle or access to mm-hmm. something that was nourishing to give it to
the granola. So the granola, so Best Calv is looking better now.
Yeah. I mean, it's a Band-Aid, right? It uh-huh. doesn't actually fix the system, but it is what is immediately called for in this moment. Like, he's telling you what he needs. This is what he needs. And also, in an ideal society, there are elders in the society. And I don't mean that from an age perspective. I just mean like people who are integrated, right? Mm-hmm. and able to show up to hold society up, which includes being able to hold a container for this man. Mm. So whether that means a bunch of people going to him and giving him words of encouragement, right? Who have the wherewithal and the sense of safety within themselves to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. Like that plus the granola bar is what I would prefer to see in an ideal society.
And then some sort of situation where the next day he won't be hungry and thirsty again in the exact same situation, which is really like a bigger role than individuals.
Right.
You know, you need some type of structure.
Yeah, for sure.
Some institutional support there.
I'm not aware of, like, I know that 311 is the number you call when you encounter homeless people who are in need of shelter, but like, I don't know that the average New Yorker knows that.
Mm-hmm. I also don't know if there's enough
resources
like, available for everyone who does need it.
Right.
And you've got Eric Adams now talking about increasing, you know, or lowering the threshold for involuntary commitment for people that display mental health disorders. I'm not sure where that means they go or what type of help that means they get.
That's a rock and a hard place right there.
Yeah. But it seems to me that, you know, you can't have, when I was in Portland being for me, I think even more than San Francisco, the kind of apotheosis of this, mm-hmm. whatever the
great word.
Yeah. Whatever the thing happening in contemporary American cities is, Portland is the extreme limit of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, it gets to a point where you can't conduct business as usual in large swaths of downtown. The Apple store has 3 layers of fencing around it and armed security guards. Like it's you're in the green zone in Iraq, mm-hmm. you know, in 2008. I mean, it's really crazy. And like people can't live and work that way. So the government does. I mean, you can't have a just kind of complete libertarianism in the streets, you know,
for sure. That's right.
And, you know, it's not just New York or the West Coast. It's D.C. It's everywhere. Mm. I mean, it's right steps away from the Capitol. I mean, you go to D.C. in the middle of the day, you can go, you can want to withdraw money from a bank. But in the lobby of the bank, people are just like smoking and getting high.
Oh, really?
So you're not going to go in that. They didn't actually threaten you. And there's this kind of discourse online where like a certain type of usually white appearing Twitter user says like, oh, please, Karen, like, can you deal? I mean,
it's like, no, I can't.
Well, actually, like that, you know, maybe I can't. Maybe I need to.
Or like, let's have a conversation. Like, why? Yeah. Like even the automatic reflex to respond in that way is indicative of the problem. Right. Like that automatic reflex actually demonstrates that they can't deal.
Right.
They're so like paranoid or really quite fragile about their sense of self, that any perceived threat to it is
their sense of self as like an understanding, compassionate person. They can't even,
or just like, yeah, like their sense of their place in the world, right, is so threatened that they can't even countenance people questioning, and they hear questioning as an arms race, right? Like, it's like, oh, we're about to go to war. That is not, that's unsustainable for any society.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
That's exactly right. And then there are so many people who, you know, you're kind of really nasty race realist, Richard Hanania kind of Twitter users who immediately say that this is black pathology. So
where is Albert
I think
Murray
that they poison the water. Yeah, exactly. The fake lore of, of black pathology, but they immediately poison the water. So a lot of decent people don't want to be anywhere near that.
Right. So they overcompensate.
So you actually can't have a realistic conversation about the issues, you know, but, and it leaves everybody the worse.
Right. Even the word pathology, technically speaking, means study of suffering, right?
So pathos.
Yeah, exactly. So this attempt to demonize, like one side is attempting to deify and the other side is attempting to demonize. Mm-hmm. And both of those are acts of dehumanization.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
And so we really need to get to this space where we're able to understand that what it means to be a human being is to contain that shadow and that light that we talked about earlier. And this is actually the practice of integration, right? The practice of integration, which is beautifully represented in the yin yang sign, right? Symbol is the understanding, or presupposes the understanding, that there is no shadow without light and there is no light without shadow. Like the two depend upon each other in order to exist. And so there's a lot of work that we have to do as individuals in our communities, in our societies at large. And we can all start now, you know, the people who have enough security and stability in their lives to start can start now and be those people who are going to commit to holding up society. Society doesn't just get held up by, like, I don't know, the gods in the sky. Like, it takes an active participation and relationship with ourselves, with our community, to be able to do that. I don't know if you've seen Pinocchio.
Gosh, not in some time. I have seen
You're
it
like,
in my life.
Where's this going? So I...
But it makes me think of Tucker Carlson.
Oh, tell me how?
Just telling lies.
Why are you lying, man?
Why are you lying all the time?
We should talk about Tucker because it's very interesting. Like the tweet that I read, or the text that I read about Wanting Empire, that's so interesting, right?
We should talk about that. I do want to talk about that with you because I think it's insane, actually.
Yeah, it is insane. But I want to know why you think it's insane. But wait, let me make this one.
Yeah, please.
So I saw Pinocchio like as a child, but I didn't remember it. But then I watched Jordan Peterson's Maps of Meaning lectures in 2020. And there's one episode where he talks about Pinocchio and it just came alive for me. Again.
I need to watch that. That's interesting.
Yeah. It's actually very fun to watch it while smoking weed, which I know you don't. Which I know you don't.
No, I don't. I'm not against smoking weed. Just like, please don't do that on the L train when I'm heading into the city to try to be a serious person.
Be intentional with your smoking.
Yeah.
No, but so there's a scene in Pinocchio where he's taken to Pleasure Island by this crazy dude who's trying to enslave all of these boys. So he like takes them to Pleasure Island and he says, you could just destroy everything that you see. There's a house that they destroy. Mm-hmm. They start drinking and smoking and like basically descending into chaos, right? And halfway through the scene, Pinocchio notices that all the boys start changing physically into donkeys. So they literally...
Pinocchio gets woke real quick. He's like, wait a minute.
Something's off. Yeah, he literally, they start changing into donkeys. And that's because the guy who brings these boys is actually, what his actual plan is to change them into donkeys and cart them off into slavery.
Jesus.
It's a beautiful metaphor for everything that we're talking about here, right? Mm-hmm. And so like when you're talking about the lawlessness and the breakdown and the destruction of the society, like Pinocchio actually has incredible commentary on that. If anyone wants to revisit that.
What is Peterson's point then in when he's doing the lecture on it?
Well, so Peterson is trying to, what? That's a great question. I don't know if I can. Peterson is trying to elucidate how reality works, like how reality itself works. And he's basically arguing that if you develop this relationship with reality, which is irresponsible, which is I'm just going to say fuck it and like do whatever I want and have no sense of accountability, responsibility to myself, to my family, to my community, this is what actually ends up happening.
Do you know what? He's right.
Yeah.
Shout out to Jordan Peterson. He's actually a really nice guy.
Yeah.
We had lunch once.
Cool.
And I mean, it was an amazing kind of performance. He ate just an ungodly amount of Wagyu
steak.
Beef. Nothing but Wagyu beef. I just couldn't.
Is he still on his red meat diet?
Oh, yeah.
That's weird.
And he kind of had this amazing ability, like, to speak for 2 hours,
mm-hmm.
basically, but, like, across such a breadth of
he's channeling
topics,
for sure.
it was amazing. It was almost like a personal Joe Rogan experience where I just got like 2 hours of it was very interesting.
I would love to see him, Peterson, in conversation with Cornel West.
Oh man, that wouldn't be bad. Yeah, I mean, I spent the weekend with Cornel,
with Brother West.
We did a conversation together, mm-hmm. Where we've done, this is like the third time we've been in conversation together, but the first time in person because COVID had it by Zoom. And so I love this man.
Yeah.
Dr. Cornel West, first of all, I think he might be the smartest person I've ever met. He is an absolute genius.
Yeah.
He's also maybe the kindest person I've ever met. When no one is watching, peeling off a 20 and giving it to this person that no one thought of, or, you know, always anybody that wants to come
That's
up to
beautiful.
Him and talk to him. He's got time. He'll take their number. He'll give his number.
Wow.
He'll give advice. He'll hug. The man is just a force.
That's beautiful.
He's also funny as hell. Like, we were in line at the airport going through security, and I just realized, I was like, Brother West, where are your bags? He was like, I never travel with bags. He's like, I'm a free black man. I got to be ready to run.
Oh my God.
It was amazing. It was amazing. And then, like,
I have so many questions, first of all.
You know, the TSA agent, you know, people are coming up to him constantly, by the way. I've been around actors and musicians. I've never seen someone be approached more than Cornel West. I mean, hundreds of people over the course of 2 days. TSA agents coming to give him a hug.
Yeah.
Everybody loves him. In the line, you know, they said, like, take off your shoes unless you're 75 years old, then you can leave your shoes on. And he was like, you try to tell me if I'm 75 years old, I'm no longer a threat? Everyone in the line loved it, laughing. He's just funny.
That's awesome.
He's great. I would love to see those two in conversation, because the thing about our talk that we do together is called The Absolute Condemnation of No One. It's about how to achieve a redemptive society.
Yeah.
And one of West's main points is that he doesn't cancel people. He'll talk to people even when they have disagreement. There's some type of common ground that you can find to build on. And I think it would be really fascinating to see him in conversation with someone like Jordan Peterson, who they would disagree on things. But, you know, you've done his podcast, actually, right?
For sure.
What was that like?
It was cool. I had just finished Maps of Meaning, the book.
And he found you.
Yeah. And he didn't know that I was like following him for for a long time, even pre-COVID. But it was great.
Why did he reach out to you? Do you know or do you remember?
I think it was just to talk about DEI and...
Oh, he's talking to you about Theory of Enchantment.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, which has a lot of overlap with Maps of Meaning in terms of our common love for Jungian stuff. There's a lot of Jungian stuff in Maps of Meaning and in his worldview in general, a lot of like archetypal hero's journey style thinking. So, but yeah, it was great. We vibed a lot. I thought it was a good vibe. He also, it would be interesting to see him in conversation with Cornel West because they both have a musical dialectic in the way that they converse with people.
Mm-hmm. They're both very talented, like not just speakers or communicators, but performers.
Right.
They have a stage presence.
Right.
Both of them. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've been amazed at how Jordan Peterson was able to, he was like ready. He was just in academia for decades, but then he was ready for the moment the cameras turned on to like seize that moment with like a persona, stage persona. But I do want to talk to you about Tucker Carlson.
Oh, yeah.
Speaking of liars. You know, this speaking of liars like Pinocchio, I want to say, I'm not throwing shade at anybody. And the only liar who's not a fictional character here is Tucker Carlson. he texts to one of his producers, a couple of weeks ago, I was watching video of people fighting on the street in Washington.
Yeah.
A group of Trump guys surrounded an Antifa kid and started pounding the living shit out of him. Hmm. It was 3-1, at least. Jumping a guy like that is dishonorable, obviously. It's not how white men fight.
Mm-hmm.
Yet suddenly I found myself rooting for the mob against the man, hoping they'd hit him harder, kill him. I really wanted them to hurt the kid. I could taste it. Then somewhere deep in my brain, an alarm went off. This isn't good for me. I'm becoming something I don't want to be. The Antifa creep is a human being. I mean, and it
is
keeps
becoming
going on.
Not white.
But so I want to emphasize that, yes, at some point, he pulls back and he says that on some level, he's aware that he's tripping. But but he doesn't actually understand that one of the things that's the craziest thing that he said is like he racializes something that, first of all, has nothing to, this is just pure racecraft. It has nothing to do with race, these behaviors. You know, have you ever been to England and seen a soccer game?
Yeah.
I mean, football hooligans
like
in Europe.
They
do nothing but gang up on people. So the idea that white people fight like in like chivalrous duels and like only people of POC.
Right. What is he smoking?
Gang up on people is insane.
That's weird.
It's just that his brain works that way. And you realize that he was the most watched person in the media and, you know, guiding the thoughts subtly and not subtly on racial matters in this country. It's like horrifically irresponsible and poisonous.
Do you think he always had this worldview, or he sort of transmogrified into...
Good question. Because, you know, he used to be like a regular kind of journalist, like libertarian, establishmentarian, Republican.
Yeah.
He was on PBS.
Yeah.
You know,
But,
you know, it's a good question. Like, what is in people's minds, actually? Mm. You know, is that how a lot of people walk through the world thinking that just any number of behaviors that don't have a racial component actually are racialized?
Right. Also, what is the relationship between celebrity of that nature, a celebrity meaning in a hyper polarized context where you are incentivized to be ridiculous and to racialize, right? You're incentivized to racialize in doing battle with the progressive, right? You're incentivized to racialize the other way, right? And then, you know, the numbers come, the money comes, the fame comes, the power comes. Like, how does that actually transform you into this monster?
Yeah, this monster that you're even able to narrate the monstrosity of your own feelings and thoughts. Like he does, he says, I realized I didn't like what I'm becoming.
Yeah.
I wonder about that. I mean, we should think more about what is going on in the minds of some of these people that have these enormous megaphones.
I mean,
he's not the only one. He's just the biggest example.
Right. I was sort of disappointed, though, to see that most people, maybe I missed it, but like a lot of people didn't seem to talk about the second half of his text.
Well, that was even omitted from the coverage, right? Like in the headlines, they didn't even...
Again, irresponsible. Which
it is irresponsible because I don't like anything to do with this text, but he spends fully half of it walking back.
Yeah, interrogating
the thing that caught all of everybody's attention, the main headline.
Yeah. And I'm just like, I don't know if you know Daryl Davis, the famous dude who got...
I know of him.
Yeah, a lot of the KKK people have come out of the KKK. But like, I read that, and even when I saw the part about white people, I was not triggered at all. It's interesting, because I would usually have felt a physical trigger response, but I wasn't triggered at all. And I think it's partially because I'm familiar with Daryl Davis's work, and it's like, in a process of de-radicalization, like, crazy people are going to say crazy shit, right?
That's true.
So, like, I could easily see this as a part of a continual or a timeline in which even someone like Tucker becomes reformed, de-radicalized, whatever you want to call it. But like the society in which we live in is just not conducive. The conditions are not conducive to even like steward that.
I mean, that's
that
a good
process.
Or is there a kind of mainstream, you know, I'll be honest, is there a kind of mainstream bias against people that are radicalized in that direction to the right? But, you know, a guy like Mehdi Hasan, who's got this big show on MSNBC or wherever they televise this guy, you know, he was saying some of the most just horrific stuff when he was a fundamentalist Islamist about, you know, about infidels being cattle. You can lie to them. You can abuse them. They don't matter.
Oh, I didn't know this.
Yeah. He's got televised speeches calling like basically non-Muslim swine, you know, and you can treat them anyway. Like
good
morality
God.
Doesn't apply to them because they're not believers.
Yeah.
And then, you know, he's got his, you know, I've changed my mind. Now I'm a good progressive and I get to scold everybody else in my British accent on American TV. But he gets none of
Thomas.
The scrutiny. I don't like this guy at all. He gets none of the scrutiny from the New York Times or anywhere else that they direct at Tucker Carlson or other people from the right. And I, you know, I do think there is a double standard for that type of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, Mehdi Hasan, everybody's like, well, that was in the past and he's redeemed. Mm. You know, it's weird.
Yeah. I also think that people have this weird thing with brown people. People on the left often
They can't be held accountable for bad views.
Or amuletize brown people. That's part of the deification, right? Which is the opposite, but the same impact as demonization. And that's something that we are really, I mean, there's a whole Christian thing happening here in the background, right? There's a whole, like, I don't know what you would call it, Christian telos that is at play and through all of this, whether you're on the right and the left. This is, again, a deeply Protestant country. And it's showing up regardless of what side you're on. And that, like, savior complex and victim complex, which is wrapped up in the savior complex. It's like churning right now in the present moment.
Yeah, I think that you can't talk about the American psyche without thinking about how deeply Christianized it is, even when people are unaware of that. I mean, that's been understood for quite some time, but I don't think we actually take it as seriously as we might, right?
Yeah. I think growing up in a religious home made me take it seriously. Not only just...
How religious was your house?
Oh, religious.
Really?
Yeah.
Wait, you were Seventh-day Adventist?
I wasn't Seventh-day Adventist, but it was like, it could be classified as that because I went to church on Saturday instead of Sunday. But what was interesting about the way I was raised was my parents trained me to look for what's beneath the surface of what's happening in society. So, like, I didn't grow up celebrating Christmas. And on Christmas Day, my parents would, like, have us, I have four sisters, they would have us in the living room and we would just, like, read about Emperor Constantine and the history of... Yeah. So it was very, like...
When we were just, like, with the Game Boys.
Let's talk about the Council of Nicaea and the Church Fathers and the Mithras cult and how December 25th was... So... My parents trained me to look for what was beneath the surface of what is happening in the present day. So history is very present, always present for me in the way I look at the world. And so it's like, it's so clear to me that Christianity is like everywhere.
It really is.
It's the water we swim in.
Yeah, it really is. And the idea of a kind of either a savior figure or a scapegoat figure.
Right.
I think a lot about, I'm working on this book trying to make sense of 2020. And I think that the way that George Floyd died, for example, the horrific video of that, and just the way that we mapped meaning onto what we were seeing was, you know, that he was like a sacrificial figure dying for the sin the original sin of our white supremacy and racism in this fallen country. And, you know, the religious overtones were everywhere and the muralizing of him and the kind of the enshrinement of the scene in front of the cup food where people made pilgrimages
and put candles and the BLM signs as as the blood on the doorposts.
Yeah,
so to show that the angel of death will pass over you. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I know, it's weird. I mean,
super Christian.
I'd love to get into like a longer conversation with you about that on another occasion.
Sure.
And I hope we can do this conversation again. I really enjoyed it.
Me too.
I feel like the time flew by.
Yeah, for sure. Oh, is it over? It is.
We're out. We're out of time.
We're out.
That flew by. I've got so much more to talk to you about, though.
Likewise. Is there anything you want to promote before we wrap this up?
Just stay tuned to Wrongthink. This space will keep evolving and changing and having exciting conversations with really dope people. And this is one of my favorites so far.
Awesome.
Cool. Thank you. That was cool. That was fun.
Yeah, that really did fly by.